You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
All right, let's get started. I have a feeling that we're going to have so much to talk about today that we're going to absolutely run out of time at the end of this panel, and I want to make sure that we cover all of the questions and the topics that you're interested in talking about in addition to our own agenda. I've got some brief business to take care of before we dive into the panel and our wonderful panelists. Tim just asked me to remind all of you that there are two final sessions after this panel. Those sessions are final report of the Internet Safety Technical Task Force and a panel on digital copyright. And then after that, there'll be a cocktail reception. So I encourage all of you to stick around for all of that. Now let's move straight into our panel. I'm absolutely thrilled to be up here with a panel of all gentlemen whom I respect and admire for the depth of their expertise in the field, for their experiences in campaigning and governance, and also because they've had so much time to actually sit down and look at the bigger picture of all of these issues. My name is Julie Barco Germany, and I run a think tank at George Washington called the Institute for Politics, Democracy, and the Internet. So we talk about these things a lot. One of the things I find most frustrating when people talk about the election is they say, oh, Barack Obama, wow, he won the election by using Facebook, or he won the election by using YouTube, didn't he? And I say, okay, all right, you're excited, you're interested in the internet. It wasn't just the tools. There were some very interesting philosophies as well. And how are the ways that the Obama campaign used internet, and then all of the candidates used internet, changing the face of campaigning, but also changing the world of policymaking? So we have these gentlemen here today to help us sort things out. I want to start at the far end of the table and introduce Simon Rosenberg first. Simon is the founder and president of NDN, a progressive think tank that is incredibly cutting edge, holds marvelous events, and has done a lot of research in the area of policy and governance and innovation and technology. And next to Simon is, of course, Cyrus Krohn, who is the Director of Online Communications at the Republican National Committee. Cyrus has worked at Yahoo, at Microsoft. He was the first employee of Slate Magazine. So he has been around and can talk about the corporate angle, but also talk about what it's like incorporating some of those cutting-edge things into a political party that's been accused in the media lately of being behind when it comes to incorporating technology into the way it does things. Sitting next to Cyrus is John Henke. John's a political blogger and an online strategist with New Media Strategies. He's worked with candidates like Fred Thompson and George Allen, and he's also been able to work with a group called Arts and Labs. Is that it, John?
Correct.
And next to John is Sam Graham Felsen. Did I get that right, or is it the other way around? Sam was a blogger for the Barack Obama campaign, and he's been able to work with the transition, and he's now at Blue State Digital. And closest to me is Garrett Graff. Garrett Graff is editor-at-large of Washingtonian, and he works at Washingtonian website. He was the first blogger to be admitted to a White House press briefing, and he was the webmaster for Howard Dean. So a range of experiences on this panel, from campaigning to governance to new media and strategy, and I thought we'd dig right in. Now, campaigning, policymaking, two very different things. So I thought we'd start off with this panel by talking about what are some concrete ways, some practical lessons from the 2008 campaign that can be applied to the policymaking side of things. How can we use peer-to-peer organizing and some of the cool things that Obama and McCain did on the campaign trail now in governance? And I thought we'd start by talking with Sam about some of the things that he's done on the campaign and some of the things that the transition has been up to.
Well, we don't have too much time, so I think I am going to, when it comes to the campaign, actually talk about how YouTube change things. How many people in this room saw a YouTube video from the Barack Obama campaign? So almost all of you. I think the reason why so many people saw YouTube videos, for one, is that we produced so many. We produced 1,800 videos. I don't know what the standard number of TV commercials that are usually produced in a single campaign is, but it's sure not close to 1,800. We produced extremely sort of micro-targeted videos. We produced videos for specific constituencies and demographics. We produced short, funny, sort of viral videos, but we also produced long, kind of in-depth, documentary-style videos, sometimes ranging from 20 to 25 minutes, that would focus maybe even on a supporter, a single supporter, with no footage of Barack Obama at all. And people watch those videos. And I think the effect that producing such a volume of videos and such a wide breadth of types of videos had was that ultimately we created something, hopefully, for everyone. There was some video that affected everyone in this room in a personal way. And when you get that sort of personal connection, folks who consume these videos are then motivated to share them with friends. And I think that's sort of the critical kind of lesson in terms of the content, what was new about how we use content to spread a message on the campaign. Because people don't usually call their friend and say, hey, did you see that awesome, TV commercial? Wait in front of your TV for the next 3 hours and maybe you'll see it again, But they do say, hey, I just saw this amazing YouTube video from the Obama campaign. I wanted to share it with you. It touched me personally. And I think that has a real big impact. Going to the transition stuff, just to clarify, I'm not directly working with the transition. I know folks over there and have been in discussions with them. I'm helping out, actually, with the Presidential Inaugural Committee and some of the DNC stuff. But I think the transition has done a great job of sort of democratizing content on the change.gov website. They have, I don't know how many folks have used the Open for Questions tool, but over 100,000 people actually signed up to use this tool. There were 4 million votes cast. Basically, the way it worked is you could submit a question and then vote up the question, and some of the highest, most voted on questions got answered. That actually, if you do the math, is 40 votes per user, which is a very high level of interaction and engagement. And I think, shows that people are hungry, not just to, engage for a second, but to spend real time interacting with government. Just another quick thing is these health care discussions that have been happening across the country, I think have been a great pilot program for things to come. From discussions I've had with folks inside the transition, Dashiell is enthusiastic about these discussions and wants to continue doing them. I would just say that one other thing is, the economy is obviously on a lot of folks' minds right now. It's the thing on folks' minds right now. And what they're doing on the transition and will probably continue to do in the administration is in addition to sort of traditional communications, they're adding sort of new media and rich media to deepen the communication with citizens about, these important issues like the economy. So, for example, the transition has gone, I think, to great lengths to do pretty in-depth interviews with a lot of the key figures on the economic transition team. And at a time of economic crisis, I think that means a lot to people. And I know that I have to wrap up, but basically, and another thing recently that was that happened on change.gov is Robert Gibbs, press secretary-to-be, took questions, some of them tough questions, hard questions, from the public, on the economy. And that's a new thing. I don't know if that's been done before. you know, we're basically, there's a virtual press conference type thing where the public can ask questions and not just guys like Garrett. So,
sure.
Anyway, I can expand more on this later, but.
You've picked up on, I think, an important trend here, Sam. Everything that Sam has mentioned so far, let me go through the list. Something for everyone when it comes to web videos and content. And then he talked about democratizing content and the open questions. He talked about that being used with Robert Gibbs, addressing the economic crisis, which has been something that everybody's obsessed with. And he also talked about healthcare discussions. So everything he's mentioned either points to the individual, the constituent, the customer, or it's talked about using new media in a way that allows interaction and conversation between the people involved in the administration and the transition and their constituents. So two-way communication, something for everyone. These are big things. Most companies with tons of money and tons of employees at their disposal can't even address this accurately. How can we expect policymakers to address this? Cyrus and Simon, from your experiences, how hard is this? What kind of practical lessons, what kind of tools do policymakers have at their disposal to do these kinds of things?
Hey, thanks for coming. We dabbled in this over the campaign cycle, specifically right before the convention in Minnesota with the Republican Party platform. And I think it's an example that's emblematic of sort of what's happening here as campaigns move into the policy realm. The goal was to change the way that the party platform is established, where, you know, historically you would get in your car and drive to a hearing and hope that you get a chance to speak at the microphone and, you know, hope that your comments were incorporated and, you know, ultimately a platform is produced. Very few people read them after they're produced, but they you know, have a lifespan of 4 years. So we wanted to change that dynamic a little bit and invite the general public, regardless of party affiliation, to come and contribute to the Republican Party platform that was ratified in Minneapolis. So, you know, we used some standard off-the-shelf software that allowed anybody to come and create an account, tell us what they thought, you know, positions should be on various issues from, you know, national security to immigration. And over the course of about 4 weeks, over 160,000 people accessed the site and submitted over 13,000 entries, both text and video. And what's more important than just the one-way delivery of the individual's comment was the two-way interaction. There were discussion groups where people could bounce ideas back and forth, but those comments were all read and digested and reviewed during the platform committee hearings in Minneapolis, and ultimately a portion of them incorporated into the living, breathing document. So if you go to GOPplatform2008.com, you'll see that Americans across the country now have a presence in the party platform document, you know, that will exist for the next 4 years. And you can begin to envision how this same tactic begins to be deployed in, you know, policy making, where an individual gets to contribute in that regard. And then I'll pass it over to Simon.
So a couple thoughts today. And Julie, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. You know, look, Obama's going to change the game with government the way he changed the game with politics. I mean, they've already begun it in the transition. And it means that in a congressional office, the expectation of your constituents is going to change about how they're going to relate to you. You have no choice other than to track and follow how Obama's changing expectations about what government looks and feels like in over the next 8 years. Obviously, it's central to his brand. They're doing it with great intensity already. And we should expect, though, that the experimentation is going to happen not just in the White House, but there will be competition inside the administration. Daschle will do stuff, and Janet Napolitano will do stuff. And then, you know, my joke is that at the Monday cabinet meeting, the DHS and HHS directors will be comparing notes on how many YouTube views they got on their video on Friday and how many comments they got on their blog post when they come in and see each other. And certainly there is going to be, I think, you know, if you want to give the shiny apple to the teacher, I mean, the, you know, using these tools now is going to become a critical way that Barack's going to evaluate the performance of his own team outside of the White House in the Cabinet Department. So I think the experimentation is going to, there's going to be massive competition inside the government for adoption of this stuff. And it means that Congress, you're going to have to keep up, right? I mean, congressional staff are going to have to keep up because voters will be experiencing government in a much more authentic, transparent, two-way manner. And if your office or committee or whatever it is that you're involved in isn't have that same look and feel and same authenticity, it's going to feel quickly like you are living in a world of a black box and not sort of being honest and transparent with the citizens about the stuff you care about. So I think there's going to be tremendous pressure over the next few years for using these tools in legislating and governing. Second is that, you know, what the tools are and what the right combination are is going to continue to change. There's an argument that the velocity of change with tools will actually be greater in the next 2 to 4 years than it has been in the last 4 years. Television as we know it simply just won't exist by the fall of 2010. I mean, I think there's a strong argument that, you know, broadcast TV is going to go the way of Citibank in the next 2 years, and certainly you're seeing the change accelerate, and we're also going to see the explosion of mobile phones in a way that we haven't. So I think there's going to be a very different environment, a tools environment, going forward than there's been backwards. And remember, just 4 years ago, there was no YouTube and Facebook, right? So, I mean, there's been tremendous change. And the third point is that I think that there is no, I mean, Julie, to your question, is that there's no right answer. There's no right way to do this, but it's going to require, you know, a level of experimentation and letting go and finding the right fit for each individual member or committee issue. And there's really no sort of one-size-fits-all. I mean, you could argue there are some members of Congress who will not benefit from putting YouTube videos up, and that was a joke. And you know who they are. But and so that's why I think figuring this out in a way that's consistent with the brand and the style of individual members is going to be, you know, very critical. But I think experimenting and embracing and diving in is not an option any longer. It's a question of how you do it, not whether you do it.
Cyrus, what do you think about that?
I want to talk about Simon's TV point. I don't disagree whatsoever. I think the time frame is not 2 years. I think it's closer to 10 to 12 years. But we are in this intermediary period where we're focused on the internet and the monitor, but that's really just the middle ground before the set-top, the TV and the monitor converge, whether it's a mobile monitor or you're physically on your sofa. Television, as we know it, will change, and it will be a central nervous system that incorporates throughout the home. But I don't think it's 2 years. I think it's
let me just give you one data point on this, and we'll turn it over to others, is that when I graduated from college in 1985, 90% of anybody watching a TV was watching live broadcast television. Today it's about a third of people who are watching it. And what you're now going to see in the next 2 years, and you saw this coming out of CES, is that, you know, TVs are now coming embedded with Netflix's, you know, I mean, the TV manufacturers, the guys who build the TVs, have figured this out, that they want to create embedded mechanisms in the physical device. This is where the change is going to come. Not only is the DVR usage continuing to skyrocket, but the physical box called the television is immediately going to go through radical transformation in a way that is going to accelerate, I think, the decline of the broadcast option as the best option.
Yeah, so appointment viewing. Yeah.
Appointment,
years,
yeah, yeah.
And I would just add on that point that I think it'll be it'll be a lot easier for people who understand the internet to deal with this convergence than for people who understand TV, just traditional TV communications to deal with this convergence.
Let's talk about the digital divide a little bit, and then let's pull back and talk about some implementation.
Sure. I was just going to pick up sort of to Simon's point, though. I think I'm more with Cyrus's time frame, because you have to remember that a large enough percentage of the country is still using analog antennas, that the government is going to push back the digital TV transition at this point, because that still represents a large enough chunk. And I think that we have sort of a real challenge going forward with governance, looking at the extent to which sort of people are left behind out of this this information revolution. You know, the sort of the great example was if you at the Citadel YouTube debate, which was the Democratic YouTube debate in the fall of 2007. If you went about 2 miles down the road from the Citadel where the YouTube debate was being held, you ended up in a public housing project where there was no broadband internet access. And in fact, the Washington Post did a very nice piece about a girl in that complex who, for her, the closest computer was a half-hour walk away at the public library, and that she was only allowed to use that computer 2 hours a day if she arrived in time to sign up for one of the slots. So one of the, I think, governing challenges going forward, and you've seen actually a lot of talk about this in the last couple of weeks in terms of the economic stimulus package, is the extent to which that the U.S. Commits to building a broadband and then I think later a wireless internet infrastructure for this country that allows it to move forward with a more rapid pace into the future.
Garrett, you've given us an interesting, and Simon and Cyrus as well, you've given us an interesting policy issue to address here on this panel, the role of the rollout and broadband implementation and technology policy. My question next, I think, is for John. John, if you were going to address a policy like this as an elected official, as a Hill staffer, how would you use the internet and technology in order to advance your issues and build? That was fun. Build consensus around your issue and also organize your constituents and supporters.
So we're going here from an interesting policy discussion. By the way, I'm going to say 8 years, and it's not necessarily going to be convergence on the TV, but I think game consoles could actually, because there's a lot more things than just the television and internet that need to converge, leaving that aside. Stepping back to the 30,000-foot view here, I think that it's important to remember that what we're going through now is sort of a communications transition, and it's not quite like the transition from radio to television, because the internet is not simply a distribution channel. But in some ways, it is like that. Whenever we go through these transitions, it requires a lot of unlearning. People essentially try to port over what they knew from previous iterations of communication. A lot of people now are trying to port over what they've learned in direct mail to email. And so you get emails that are gargantuan, lots of images, 1,000 words in it, because that's how you put together an email, or that's how you put together direct mail. And after all, direct mail is email is mail that goes directly to somebody. So it's the same, right? Well, no, that's not how people consume email. The emails you find most interesting and that you actually read and act on generally are 2, 3, 4 sentences from somebody you know. So gradually, some of those things, I think, are going to be unlearned, and the same will be true in the policy environment. It's important to remember that the innovations that happen in government and political organizations are going to be state-of-the-art 2005. I mean, how much credit did Obama get for putting his radio addresses on YouTube? Uploading things to YouTube is not exactly cutting edge in 2009, but for government, it was very, very innovative, and they're going to be dealing with a lot of different perverse incentives inside, because the innovative, important things that people working in technology want to do don't necessarily accord with the interests of the bureaucrats or the people who are, you know, communicating or doing whatever. There are different incentives at play, and there's going to be some conflict between those. So as we're going through this transition, do you ever see the movie Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? There's the scene in the movie where the governor is walking up to an old radio station in the 30s, I guess. And as he's walking in, his aide comes up to him and says, "Hey, do you want to go shake that guy's hand over there? You know, press the flesh of the voter." And he says, "No, we ain't one at a time in it anymore. We're mass communicating now." And that was true. At that time, they'd gone from retail politicking, and they were emerging or moving into an era of more mass communication. There were massive economies of scale in terms of getting your message out, reaching a lot of people, persuading people, and reaching them in general. We've gone about as far as we can go, I think, down that path. I mean, the marginal advantage of another TV spot or another radio spot or another newspaper advertisement, there's only so much of that. And this applies in the policy world as well. There's only so much advantage to that kind of mass communicating. The internet allows us to move back towards the one at a timing it, the retail politicking, where you actually reach out to people and form relationships. Now, it doesn't mean you're communicating with them personally, individually, one-on-one, but it's a much more personal relationship-oriented thing. People actually had relationships with the Obama campaign. They actually interacted with it. It was not brochure that they could go and look at, and that was the end of their interaction. There were communities inside, and there was response they got from the Obama campaign. There was a lot of listening. And that gets to the final point I want to make on this, which is that what policymakers can do is not simply in communication and outreach and pushing information out, but in responding, getting information back. The internet is not scientific polling, but it's a great soundboard, and you can find out what people are saying, reacting to in real time, and move on that, and targeting smaller audiences and being very responsive to them. And that inoculates you against a lot of the problems that can happen. I'm sure you guys found out over and over again. The FISA example was great. It was happening, and within days, or you know, even the same day, they knew it was happening, and they could formulate a response instead of waiting until it hit their desk weeks later.
Sam, what happened with that FISA thing? Why don't you talk about that a little?
Sure. So I was did the blog outreach for the Obama campaign. So you know, I was, of course, getting bugged about this for a long time, because it was an issue that was, you know, probably the preeminent issue for progressive bloggers. Basically, I don't know if folks know about this story, but basically, a blogger, I'm not sure if he actually started the group or if he was an early member of this group, but it was a group on mybarackobama.com, the social network that we created for our supporters, ostensibly, but for anyone to use. They created a group saying that, you know, we support you, Barack Obama, but, you know, we ask you to change your mind on, you know, your position on FISA. You know, they didn't actually threaten to withdraw their support, but they made their views known loud and clear. And, you know, I knew that we weren't going to you know, change the decision because folks were, because certain folks were upset about it. But folks inside the new media team, you know, and the communications team felt that, you know, this was a group that actually grew to, what, 25,000 people in a few days. And, you know, we felt that it deserved a respectful response. Barack Obama wrote a real response. He engaged them in a dialogue and said, look, you know, I'm not going to change, but I respect you for protesting on my site and making your voices heard. And, you know, I want you to keep, you know, ribbing me where you disagree with me. And, you know, I hope we can continue this conversation. It didn't make everyone happy, but I think it made a lot of people feel respected. And I would say that the risk of opening up, you know, and on your websites, you know, opening up tools that will allow people to register complaints in a clearer way and allow people to even build mini sort of movements on your own sites, the risk is that, you know, you'll have to be dealing with some more sort of visible criticism. You know, at least in our case, when you respond respectfully, even if it's a disagreement, your constituents will really appreciate it.
Garrett, how would you handle a situation like that?
Well, I think the most important thing that the Obama campaign did right in the FISA debate was not trying to shut the discussion down.
That was something we didn't even discuss, whether or not we were going to shut it down. We were always going to leave it up.
When you sort of go through all of these crisis communication case studies, the natural response is to delete the posting or block the user or take down the comment or what have you, and that is sort of the absolute worst response. I think they handled it just about perfectly insofar as they really, you know, saw it happening within their own site, and then formulated a response and responded to it in a very respectful, but not necessarily, you know.
And by the way, the response was from the actual Barack Obama, which I think makes a difference.
Yeah.
And I think, in, especially in the internet age, folks are a lot savvier about knowing which stuff is probably written by the person versus the staff. So.
Yeah. And I think that the other thing that is worth noting, though, is that you also have to be very wary of what the percentages are that you are dealing with. A group like in the Obama campaign, 25,000 people is a huge number of people to take action on a specific topic. But at the same time, if you're talking about a list that reaches about 10 million people, 25,000 is a very small minority of that group. And so just as you would not necessarily in offline give outsized credence to a small vocal minority, you sort of don't want to be held hostage online to that group either.
Cyrus, how would you handle this if it were, let's say, a flood of email instead of a multitude of posts online?
If I can answer that, it is a slightly different way in
sure.
terms of infiltrating other communities. We're seeing a lot of this, and it has profound implications in the thought process around how to react to a particular issue. There were multiple times during the course of the campaign cycle where MoveOn found out about something we had going on our website or a community group and sent out an email to their supporters, and within a matter of 15 minutes, the results, information, or comments were skewed so dramatically that, one, we had to think about the prior point as to whether or not we removed them or not, but also that there was a coordinated campaign to skew information in such a way that it became detrimental to our project and deterred participants from wanting to engage further. And I personally witnessed the power of MoveOn.org this cycle in ways that I had only read about. And I just am curious what these people are doing all day, because I'm always on my keyboard. But, I mean, when Marcos or whomever, flips the switch, boy, people jump.
Yeah.
I think just to answer your question specifically, you've got to apply a filter to the information that comes in because of the openness of communication chains now. And it's not unlike when your phones are ringing off the hook in the offices because somebody's created a coordinated campaign to dial in. And honestly, we were using online actions for offline activity specifically like that, sending out emails to our supporters to call particular offices on special issues, knowing that those calls were logged in ways in which maybe emails weren't being responded to or logged. And I'm actually curious to ask those in the audience that audience that receive inbound emails how those are distinguished between a phone call or a franked mail or et cetera, because it's just a whole new dynamic.
I always wondered about that too. Do you guys care as much about emails as phone calls?
Everyone I've talked to have said no. Is there anybody who?
If you have constituents calling to complain about something, how many emails is equivalent to one phone call in terms of you guys saying, we better do something about this? That's one thing. I've always been curious.
Is there assurance that it's come from your district?
Well, and I think that Cyrus is getting at an interesting point, that I see that there being sort of two very different terms that we talk about here that we sort of lump together, but they mean very different things. When the Obama campaign talks about how transparent and accountable it was as a campaign and it will be as a government, I think that the Obama campaign has, and I give them tremendous credit for what they have done, but I think that they have done a very good job of appearing to be transparent without actually being accountable. That, this idea of we're going to post our radio YouTube address online, well, that's great, but it's still Barack Obama talking unfiltered and unchallenged and saying the precise thing that he is interested in saying in any given week. And when you go on the YouTube channel, they have turned off comments for those videos, and they have turned off video responses. So while they are...
That's still true.
I think that Cyrus was, that brought this up last
No, I got beaten up on that on a previous panel because I made the same point, and they have since changed it. But
oh, okay.
Yes, they did. There was a point in which there was no 2A.
Well, good
and,
for you.
It is true that not everything is opened up. And by the way, we did, I mean, you know, we did not allow pernicious groups that were clearly not in any way interested in supporting Obama and just wanted to sabotage things. We did not allow those to flourish, but it was clear in the case of the Pfizer group that it was a serious group that had, you know, a valid, issue-based complaint. But on your point about, lack of necessarily accountability, it's true that, just because someone voted on, an issue on the internet, like, it's true that, policy staffers aren't going to reverse decisions that they've made after, consulting, top professors, and think tanks across the country. And that wouldn't be wise at all.
Right.
But what I do think is key is, in the past, if a constituent was upset about something, let's use a campaign, for example. I'm not sure how this applies to the governance mode, but if supporters were upset about something, they would basically have to be either an incredible organizer who got a whole bunch of people to join him, or a savvy media operator who convinced, a major newspaper to cover them for the campaign to even know about their complaint, right? Now the campaign does know about your complaint because it's on your actual website. Like they've definitely seen it. And the fact that they allow it to happen on their website and the fact that it's guaranteed that they're going to see it, I think, is a major step forward. And potentially can evolve into a much deeper sort of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Simon, John, what's the long-term trend here? Do you think any of this is actually going to change the way we govern?
Go ahead. No, you, please.
I do. I think that, in the life, taking the biggest view on this, in the life of the Obama, if Obama serves 8 years, essentially everybody in the world will have a mobile phone, and that all the world's people, for the first time in all of human history, will be all connected and will have equal access to, a Google-like thing that allows them to reach all of the world's knowledge in real time, no matter where they live, anywhere in the world. And that's going to happen in the very near future. We don't know the date. We don't know the tipping point. And I think that, I boil it down to one sort of simple thing that happened with us, which is that Michelle Rhee, in her new enthusiasm as the chancellor of our schools, sent a threatening letter to the parents of a teacher of one of my kids in public school that was wrong. She got some of the data wrong. And Michelle Rhee, within 24 hours, all the parents had organized, gotten the phone number and email of the chief of staff to Michelle Rhee. He had been pounded with phone calls and emails, protesting their abuse of this incredible teacher. And it was a game, I just saw it happen. I just saw it happen in my own little community with my first grade student. And, the city backed off, and immediately. And it would have taken 3 months to have done that 10 years ago, right? And if the parents had actually really, done anything. And so I think the thing is that the long-term trend is that power is moving away from central places to people. These tools are extremely empowering to average citizens to get in the game. The barrier to entry for citizens to get involved in our politics, both here and globally, has been lowered. And I think one of the most interesting things for all, and I think this is now a permanent change. I think that the expectation of citizens about openness, transparency, about involvement, about engagement has been forever altered. And I'll leave you with two quick just stories on that. One is I was watching a sporting event on Fox, because I don't watch Fox News, certainly, one night, and in three consecutive commercials were an ad for American Idol, and what do we know about American Idol? You can vote, right? An ad for a credit card that you could design yourself and shove in your own picture and build your own credit card, and the third was for BMW, where you could design your own car, right? So three consecutive commercials on Fox were all about people's interaction with the brand and the product as part of the core transaction, right? So this is bigger than politics. I mean, this is how people expect to interact with the world. And then finally, the I think that the other thing that's going to be interesting for Barack is that it's not just going to be Americans watching these YouTube videos, right? I mean, that, you know, he will have the ability to reach the citizens of the world, unlike any American president in history. And how that affects our brand, how we can speak to others, how we can communicate our values and our beliefs in a time where our brand is beleaguered right now globally is going to be one of the most interesting things that happens. And that when, you know, when because people, you know, half the world's people now have access to the to a mobile device or the internet or the global communications network, that's going to radically increase in the next few years. And I just think we don't really know what government democracy is going to look like in this sort of real-time, universally connected, citizen-led, you know, thing that's going to come. But certainly it means that politicians are going to have to be, I think, much more, their brand is going to have to become much more two-way than broadcast. I mean, in essence, you know, Julie. And I think that's going to take a lot of unlearning, as was said, and a lot of go-forward experimentation and learning.
So
I want John's response to that, but let's open it up for questions from the audience after John.
Well, so Sam and I were talking beforehand, an idea that we have that the real power of the internet is that it enables better messaging, money, and mobilization. Or actually, I prefer to say messaging, mobilization, and money, because I believe people mobilize around the ideas, and that's what will ultimately generate fundraising dollars. So he's referring that to that in the context of the Obama campaign. That's what it did for the Obama campaign. He's absolutely right. I take the longer view that that's basically what the left did with the internet. The left used the internet to move messaging, mobilization, and money outside of the traditional, the establishment, outside of the traditional channels on the Democratic Party. And in doing so, the progressives, particularly the left roots online, developed a sort of gravitational pull. It wasn't that the Democratic establishment adopted the internet so much more easily. It was that they developed a gravitational pull, and the Democratic establishment, because they needed new channels, was forced to come to them and worked with them very well. And there were some very, very smart efforts in doing that, some infrastructure that was set up to enable that. So in the context that we're talking about here, I think it's going to allow better and more information, which allows for better mobilization, easier mobilization, lower barriers for that. It's also going to, and here's the change in politicians, it's going to result in more vulnerable politicians, because they will suddenly be subject to the little campaigns that pop up in a forum somewhere and suddenly blow up across the internet. It's also going to result in more responsive politicians, because vulnerable politicians are responsive politicians. So they are gradually, slowly, not all of them yet, but going to be watching and paying attention much more to what happens online and adjusting course, adjusting their message, adjusting their policy as a result of the little things that are happening. And they'll see it online before it happens elsewhere. Let me give you one anecdote, and then I'll wrap it. So Donald Rumsfeld, his speechwriter, I was a chief of staff in an office I worked in at one point, and he told me that the auto pin scandal, if you know about that, but apparently Rumsfeld was signing some letters to families with an auto pin. Lefty blogosphere made a huge deal of it, and this guy told me, we were aware of that in the Pentagon. We saw that. We knew about that, but we figured it's just something the blogs are talking about. We don't need to respond to the blogs. And then 2 weeks later, it blew up in the media, and they thought, wait a minute, we knew about this 2 weeks ago. We could have done something to address it and prevent it from blowing up, prevent it from being a problem 2 weeks ago, but we didn't realize that there was a permeable membrane between the blogosphere and the media. And that's increasingly, you know, a few years ago it was 2-3 weeks before it would go from one to the other. Now it's days or even hours before it goes from one to the other. So they have gradually learned that they need to watch these things that are happening, because a day, a week, a month down the road, those things that are happening online will be on their plate. So we're going to see much more responsive policymakers, not just in the messaging, but also in the policy as well.
So lower barriers of entry for average citizens to communicate, and more responsiveness from elected officials. Those are our – can we all agree on that as a panel?
Sure. And I also think, some of these things probably would, you know, make you know, folks in Congress nervous to use these tools, but think about the upsides. Think about the change that can actually be created when you engage your constituents. I think one of the key things that enabled I can't remember exactly how many volunteers we had, but it was obviously we had, I think, 2 million. You know these stats better than I do. Probably 2 million signed up on MyBo, on MyBarackObama.com. I really think that, you know, sure, we had an inspiring, charismatic guy that people were rallying around, but we made it so easy for people to engage, and they instantaneously sort of saw that they had, taken an action that made some sort of concrete difference, whether it was, they saw how many phone calls they made, or they were able to use our technology to, register, the ones and twos when they were knocking on doors, et cetera. I think that when you give people tools to make a difference and they can see that the tools are working, they're really going to want to use them when they can get a sense of their own power. So use these folks, because you're going to be able to make a much bigger difference if you do.
Adam, and I believe they're going to want you to talk into the microphone behind you.
Quick question regarding, I know you talked a little bit about vulnerable politicians and things like that. I'm interested in the idea of online authenticity. I think you're going to see candidates who increasingly running them through the filter of an internet team is going to seem kind of staid. And, part of it will probably be candidates who come in steeped in this technology and are more comfortable with it. But what ways do you think that politicians can start excelling in online authenticity? Is it, we saw some of those fakes sent from my BlackBerry messages on email lists, politicians having their own, status feeds or Twitter updates, what are the ways they can make it more authentic and believable that I think help them connect with constituents?
I think that the internet in lots of different ways is going to change the type of leaders that we select, just as television changed the type of leader that we selected and radio changed the type of leader that we would select. It is much harder to hide inauthenticity as a candidate today than it was, 15, 20 years ago. Because your constituents back home can get a picture of you much more easily, but at the same time, we are now in what I call the Miranda era of politics, where anything you say can and will be used against you. And the first victim of this, of course, was George Allen with his Macaca moment. Now, the challenge of those moments is that they aren't necessarily enough to upend someone who is seen as authentic. But they are enough to confirm an underlying or latent fear that the public has about a constituent. I worked on Howard Dean's campaign, and as you all know, we had the famous post-Iowa caucus scream moment, which was one of the first YouTube moments, even though YouTube was actually still 2 years away from being invented on the internet. But that video connected with a latent fear in the voting populace that Howard Dean was a crazy person. And George Allen's Macaca moment connected with sort of a latent fear in voters in Virginia that George Allen was a racist. And so those moments that confirm for the populace sort of something that they suspect are the ones that are most damaging. And to give you some idea, I think, of how this this could have played out in this race and the importance of being sort of authentic for when these moments happen is I talked to John McCain's advisors about 2 years ago. And they said that they were, as they were coming into this campaign, the thing that they were most scared of in the YouTube era was John McCain tripping. And the reason that they were terrified of that was the Bob Dole 96 moment where he fell off the platform, which actually, in the way that these things happen, had nothing at all to do with the fact that Bob Dole was old. It was because the sort of balcony that he was leaning against hadn't been properly secured, and so it gave way when he leaned against it. It would have happened to anyone who leaned against that. But John McCain's team were really concerned that John McCain's, not trip walking on stage or trip walking down an aisle one of them said to me, you know, if anyone strings fishing line across an aisle, we'll lose this campaign. And that's because they thought that that video replayed ad infinitum on the internet would have sort of connected with people that John McCain was too old and too frail to be president. Whereas, of course, the exact same video happening to Barack Obama would have had, you know, would have been an amusing moment for the late night shows, but would have had no overall impact on Barack Obama's campaign because there wasn't any real fear about Barack Obama's, you know, physical physique, as witnessed by all of these surfing photos from his Hawaiian vacation.
just to add, I would say, you know, I mean, the easiest way to be authentic is to, frankly, to try as much as possible to get the actual, you know, member of Congress to sometimes do blogging. I know that they can't do it that often. It's time-consuming. But a few quick things that... that I think staff can do to make online communications more authentic. I think press releases definitely need to be repurposed when you're communicating with ordinary people and not, you know, the Martians from the press, basically. You know, ordinary people don't talk or they don't read things the way that they're presented in press releases. So just slapping a press release on a blog is a bad, bad idea. Repurpose it, put it in normal language that ordinary people want to, you know, can understand and want to read. Secondly, you know, one of the things that I really tried to do on the campaign, because it is a real challenge, of course, you know, being on message and being authentic, was I elevated our supporters. And I would spend half an hour to an hour sometimes just interviewing supporters, getting their story, and getting the nuances of their character. And I think authenticity is ultimately about nuance and details. And the best writing includes a lot of details and quirky, you know, things that make people human. So that's another thing I would recommend. And finally, you know, a good way other than the actual politician blogging is to, you know, occasionally take questions or just do a video. Doesn't have to be responding to questions from constituents, but just do some sort of video and do not use a teleprompter because every time we used a teleprompter, the video was not even half as good as when we just asked questions, had them respond to questions, and then edited it down. It makes an enormous world of difference. So please try to avoid teleprompters.
Excellent.
If you do web video.
And I think John and Simon both have things to add to that.
Yeah, if I can add real quick. I think to some extent we may not be looking at an era where the politicians have to be visible and authentic. Certainly they need to be authentic, but many times, you know, a politician is authentically boring. They're not the most charismatic people sometimes. And so campaigns and political offices perhaps need to think more about the transparency and authenticity being about their supporters. I think that over the long term, campaigns are going to move less away from, you know, here is our emblem, the candidate, and what can you do for him? And more towards here is who we are collectively, and what can we do for you to empower the people? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of the authenticity of the Obama campaign was in the fact that people genuinely had relationships with each other. There were a lot of networks at the state, local, and even national level through My Barack Obama. So the authenticity was they were in a community, in a circle of peers that were very authentic, even if they weren't necessarily always on the campaign message. The Obama campaign had an army of spokesmen, each of whom was free to be authentic.
I think two quick thoughts. One is that, you know, we have to expect that every town hall meeting and every meeting a politician does with any group now is likely to be videotaped through or whatever the term is, recorded through a mobile device, and that the expectation should be that there is no longer a private off-the-record moment, and that video could be captured and played millions of times. It could be John McCain falling down at a private event with 20 people that could still go out into the blogosphere and seen. And I think one of the things that we all do in our business is they're sort of on the record, off the record. And there's no more off the record, right? I mean, it just doesn't exist anymore, really, where you can't be on your game saying something that you're willing to live with the rest of your life as it goes up digitally on YouTube. And related to that, it means that politicians actually have to understand what they're talking about. And that's going to require, and I think when you talk about a different kind of leader, you know, it is going to be harder, I think, to fake it, you know, on an issue when you go in front of a town hall back at home, you know, when there are 75 people in the room, and this is the kind of thing you could mail it in the old days, and when, you know, you stumble around and can't answer a question, somebody records it, it's up on YouTube, and, you know, it's used in a campaign ad, you know, by your opponent. That is now every single time your boss or a politician appears in public for good, right? And that is a game-changing event. And those politicians that don't do their homework, I mean, because the thing about Barack is that Barack actually understood what he was talking about, right? So the authenticity was that this was a guy who knew his stuff. He could get up and talk about it without a teleprompter, right? And, you know, it means that politicians are going to have to study up, you know, and be able to answer questions of their constituents live in real time or pay incredible consequence with a recorded video from the event that a Democrat sitting in the room is horrified by the answer, if it's a Republican or the other way around, that will be used, you know, habitually, you know, throughout the rest of the politician's career. And that is a completely different, we've all done this, right? We go to an event, we kind of mail it in, you're not worrying about it. That's just, that doesn't happen anymore. And that's a game-changing event, Julie, I think, in this whole enterprise.
And that sort of leaves aside politics entirely, then I'll let you actually talk, where, you know, this is true for anyone acting in the public or private sphere at any moment. I don't know if you saw over New Year's the transit police officers in San Francisco shot an unarmed black youth on a station platform and touched off riots in Oakland. That incident was recorded live by five bystanders with their cell phones. And so you can watch the shooting take place on YouTube from five different angles. And it was those videos that really ended up sparking the riots, because it is undeniable that he was lying face down on the station platform when the police shot him in the back. And that it's, I think, sort of, you know, you go back 15 years and, you know, there was the one video of Rodney King. Yeah. And now today you would have that video being broadcast probably by several people and live instead of being waited, you know, instead of waiting for Dateline NBC to get to it.
And by the way, the folks are organizing on Facebook now. You probably know the number in the group, but a lot of these protests are now being organized. The BART protests are being organized on Facebook. Yeah.
Sir, our final question, I think. Yeah, we're almost out of time.
Phil Corwin, kind of a big picture question, but the net has clearly changed campaigning, but it really hasn't changed government that much yet. I mean, for example, yesterday I filed a comment letter to the Department of Justice on behalf of a client. It was very easy to communicate. I could send the draft letter to the board of the client. They could respond with comments. Then I filed it yesterday at regulations.gov, made it very easy to file it right at the last minute. But it's really the same. It's a different way to access the same old process. Now, getting away from the regulatory side, the executive branch side, to the legislative side, up to now, we have democracy. We don't have direct democracy. The ancient Greeks had it, and they still had it in New England town meetings, but it doesn't scale. And once you get beyond a few hundred people, we choose someone to we hope reflects the will of the group. Now you could probably make the argument going forward, well, you can't scale direct democracy. You could have on every critical issue the population of a state or the population of a congressional district vote on that issue. And I think there are no calls for this yet, and obviously it's not going to change the Constitution. But to get elected, I think people are going to have to start responding to technology. And I'm not sure if it's good or bad, because as someone, you know, who's been involved with legislative process for longer than I care to admit, that's a process where, after all the hoopla, some people get together in a back room, and it's a process of negotiation and nuance, and they come out with these complicated statutes that reflect all the different considerations and constituencies. But at least what I've seen so far on the net, it's not negotiation, it's mostly confrontation, it's mostly people all agree getting together in a group and not talking to the opposite group, and it makes issues kind of binary, black and white. And to give an example, if we had had a popular direct democracy vote on whether or not Congress should have voted for the TARP program for the bailout last fall, it probably would have failed by a very substantial amount, and the consequence might have been that the entire financial system collapsed, whereas folks who are elected in a representative democracy could say, we understand people are really angry, but we've got to do the responsible thing. So I don't have a clear question, but going forward, how is this ability to scale democracy right on a discrete policy question going to influence the legislative process?
It's a difficult question to tackle and also a question full of nuance. Which one of you would like to tackle it first? I can tell you that you sound like many well-known authors and political scientists. Cass Sunstein is one of them, who have argued similar things. And I think what we're talking about is confrontation, but there's also an element of collaboration that's starting to develop online. There's the bad with the good, the dark side of the force with the light side of the force. Garrett?
I think that you are absolutely right and that this is a real big challenge going forward, is that we hope that with representative democracy that there's a maturity in the decision-making process that is not necessarily the same as direct democracy, and that this is one of the, I think the big challenges of the American idolization of our culture, where, text yes or no to 53333, whether or not you think GM should be bailed out, that there are reasons that we don't want the masses making decisions, see gladiator fights and, Christians v. Lions circa, zero. And I think that this is going to only get a more complicated challenge as our technology progresses, and especially as things like video conferencing progress. One of the things that I think we are not too far away from seeing is, a discussion about whether it makes sense, for instance, for Congress to meet in person in Washington. Would we be better off with all 435 congressmen and women staying in their home districts full time and then meeting by video conference, but then sort of being permanently attached to their districts in a way that they are not now, because they get to come to Washington and be somewhat isolated from the people who voted for them, and thus making it easier for lobbyists, for instance, to reach them than their constituents in some matters?
What's wrong with that?
I mean, and by the way, obviously the, to take FISA as the example that we discussed before, I mean, we don't have direct democracy, so you don't have to do anything, even if the vast majority voted yes on or no on, bailout GM. Mm-hmm. So that's why I don't really think there's a harm in doing, in opening these things up and in allowing folks to vote, because ultimately it's still your decision. I mean, of course, in 2 years, it's going to be tough, but it's the benefits of all of the benefits, basically, in my book, sort of always outweigh the negatives with the internet. It's just it's such a self-correcting mechanism. Just in case I don't get any other word in, the other big thing is that, like, a lot of this stuff is so easy to do. It's really, really easy. I mean, I wish I didn't admit that, because we'll probably be all out of a job, but it's really easy to do.
So
it doesn't take that much time, and it makes a world of difference, and it's not that annoying to do it. So do some of this stuff.
So my phone tells me it's 3:20, and we're 5 minutes over time, but we can stay a few minutes longer.
One quick question. I'm just wondering whether any of you would think that a dot Obama or a dot Palin would have been a useful device or a more intuitive device during the campaign, rather than mychangeobama.com or any of the variations that had to go through. So run one more intuitive, dot Obama with variations in the second level of the domain name space.
Only if people stopped using search engines, I think.
Julie, has anybody got anything to say about that? Could I just make one just sort of final thought on the question about democracy? Is that just very quickly, do we still have time? I think this issue, I don't think we're in danger of becoming a direct democracy, but certainly I think that when broadcast and television was the dominant medium in America and the goal of marketers were to create couch potatoes, right? People who, think about that concept, right? Is that your job as a consumer was to sit on your ass and consume media and not do anything with it, right? Just sort of be a couch. I love the term couch potato. I'm going to have to explain that to my kids, like I have to explain, what a Model T Ford was, right, as a concept. And I think that this extra democracy that we're all feeling is an incredibly healthy and good thing. It's great that Americans are more involved in the destiny and life of their country. That's great that they have more ability to weigh in and you can hear from them more. In the 90s, when I worked for Bill Clinton, the way we stayed in touch is we polled, right? That's not a good way to stay in touch with voters, right? Because then it makes Mark Penn the most powerful guy in Washington, which is what was the case in the Clinton era. The second thing on the big picture front is, are we going to, I think this is a policy issue and a sort of a big idea, not just about politics, but is government going to become like Amazon.com, right? When you go at Amazon next time and you have it's personalized and all the recommendations come up for those of you who have it or some other thing like that, and then think about how you interact with the government. The government has to become like that at some point. We actually have to do this. We actually have to make government look like Amazon.com and make it that easy to use. Or my experience with Apple. The other day we bought an iMac and I had a question and I typed in, if you guys have Macs, this is our first Mac, and it says one option is for response is you get a phone call from a Mac person within 1 minute, right? I couldn't really believe this. It was on a Sunday at 2:00. I typed it in and I got a phone call at my house 30 seconds later from a live human, intelligent human being who spent 20 minutes on the phone with me answering. She kept saying, do you have any more questions? I'm like, well, yeah, I do, kind of. And so that's with Mac. And then deal with, any part of the U.S. government. That's something we are going to have to deal with. No, but we have to get real about making government be like what people's experiences are like in the rest of their lives, or their faith and confidence in all of you will continue to be what it is today.
If you like HR 1746, you'll also love HR 1744.
If I can add to that, if the internet just gives us more votes, then it has failed. I don't think that is we fetishize democracy to some extent, and it's valuable, but the Founding Fathers were wary of that for a reason. If it just gives you more votes, it's failed. A vote is not the same as a choice. The ideal here, and what Simon's talking about, is an internet that gives us more choices. If it gives us more choices in the ways we interact with the government or the access we have to information, that's a success.
Excellent. Thank you very much, gentlemen.